Okay, so to start off, I'm Scott Cunningham, and I work for Imagine Communications as an engineer in the professional services team. The products I specialize in are the Selenio Flex product range, which uses the same technology as Microsoft Azure's Workflow Designer tool. The training schedule that we're providing to Microsoft this week is 2 hour sessions per day over a 3 day period. The agenda is very flexible, and I intend to just concentrate on the areas of focus determined by you guys, so don't be afraid to stop at any time and ask questions or change the direction I'm going in. But the schedule I've put together to go over is to go over the support process quickly for the future, the overview of the designer, basic workflow concepts, and then start building blueprints from scratch that you may typically see or use in production. One being the creation of multiple MP4 files with the accompanying manifest file, which I think you use for your offline packager. We'll then start to design some more complex blueprints to be able to cope with flexible varying source file scenarios. A typical case would be dealing with audio files, source files with varying audio channels. You need to be able to build blueprints to deal with those different situations. And that would kind of lead into workflows with logic, as that logic would have to be used in scenarios with no audio or varying audio channels in the source files. Then we'll go on to graph stages briefly. I'm not sure if you've come across graph stages or used them before, but they're kind of an advanced feature in the blueprints. But you can think of a graph stage as being an entire workflow that is triggered to run or not to run as a result of a logic scenario. And I'll show you an example workflow I have that uses stage graphs in it. Then on the last day, to go over scripting inside the blueprint, restrictions of the current processor version, unless I mention them in the first 2 days, and then continue blueprint designing if required, and a lot of time for Q&A. And although I will be stopping towards the end of each session for Q&A, again, just stop me any time to ask questions if you need to. And one other thing which I think I may include is just an overview of the Azure Media Services Explorer and how to upload assets, how to test, and then how to download those assets or, you know, for testing on the local premises. So as I've said, the agenda for the training will mainly be centered on the workflow designer, so you'll see me operating that a lot. And if at all possible, you could open your own designers and do things in the background while I'm doing them. It may help. Okay, so now we're going to move on to the designer. But before we do, I'm going to go over some of the definitions of words that we use and I'll be using throughout the training. So it's important that we know the difference between them all. So the designer is the graphical interface that can be used to create and to run blueprints and graphs. The blueprint is the master file that contains all the information about the workflow. And a graph is a set of connected components. The graph can be an entire workflow solution, or it may be a specific subset of a solution. And I'll show you what that means shortly in the designer. The components themselves are the data processing elements. They have pins which are used to pass data between components, to expose properties and events, and to trigger commands. Okay, so now moving on to the designer. Once you've downloaded, installed, and got your license for the workflow designer, you can launch it in a number of ways. Most popular ways to do it are the going through the Start menu, Start All Programs, Microsoft Azure Media Services, and then Launch. Or you can type Workflow Designer in the Start menu, or the desktop icon's installed with the software, and you can run it that way. So if I just go to my designer now, So on the top left is the user files panel. This is where recently saved blueprints and graphs can be selected to quickly bring back into the workspace. And you can expand or collapse these options just by clicking on the little triangle next to the words. And you also have the option to attach a local folder that contains blueprints, so you don't have to use Windows Explorer to browse to them all the time. If I just do that now, workflows folder, if I attach it there, then all the workflows within that folder and subfolder will appear below, so I can easily get them into the workflow. And the search function at the top also allows you to search for any of the blueprints that are in recently used or in your saved folders. So it will search for any of the words in the blueprint name. On the bottom left is the repository panel. This is where the available components are utilized from. And this also uses a tree view to expand to get to your components. The search function is also very useful and is probably the main way that people would browse to components to bring them into the workspace. And again, you just type a little bit of what you think you may need, and then it will display the list of components for you. So once you have a component that you want to add to the workspace, you can just left click and just drag it in. Another way would be to right click on the back of the workspace and then do add component and then browse through this way. So the main area in the middle is the workspace, and this is where the blueprints are built, saved, and then used to execute transcoding tasks. The panel on the right side, you'll see a bunch of configurable options. And the available options that you see here depend on the component that you have selected. So at the moment, if I left click on the back of the workspace, I get options pertaining to the root blueprint. If I click on a component, for example, the media file input component, I then get options pertaining to that component specifically. Notice when you click on a blueprint, it gets highlighted in blue, and you can also select multiple components just by dragging the mouse. So, another way to view component settings, rather than just using the panel on the right, you could expand these panels if you wanted to view more of the workspace, and in that situation, you would want to display the settings by clicking on the blue eye, and that would open up the component settings in its own window. Or you can also double-click the component, and it will do the same thing. Each component, you may see, will have a question mark on it, and that will just open up the help documentation for that component. As you see here, it just has a short overview of the component and the inputs and outputs that it accepts. So one thing to point out on the interface, there are two levels of visibilities on components and component settings. So you see here on the right side for component settings at the top, there's a show advanced button. I recommend that you all make sure that you show advanced so you can see all the valuable settings for the components. And for component visibility, that's in this repository pane, some of the components are set to advanced. If you go to File, Preferences, and then Component Visibility Level, change that to Advanced, then you'll see all available components. In the bottom of the workspace is a workspace thumbnail, and this is acts as like a mini-map for when you have very large or complex blueprints. It's an easy way to navigate or move around the blueprint. you also have this little button here, and again you can have multiple workspaces open at any one time, and this tab down here just allows you to flick between them to access them quickly. On the icon toolbar at the top, you can start and stop blueprints, do copies, cuts and pastes of components, and you can also zoom in and out of the workflow as well as saving or opening new workspaces in Windows Explorer. For tidying up the appearance of the blueprints, you can highlight components and you can align them. So if I held Control left, Control down, that now spaces the components easily, so it's easier to see. Again, you can just use shortcut keys to change where the blueprints are, the components are, or you can right-click on one of them and then do layout adjustments. So that's the overview of the designer. So now I'll go to just quickly explain what the what a basic blueprint layout would look like. Okay, so this slide shows the basic layout of a transcode blueprint. More complicated blueprints will vary and look slightly different to this, but the principle is still the same. As you can see, I've grouped different types of components together that perform different tasks. So moving from left to right, I have your input component, the media file input. Then I have the data type updaters, which is just video and audio metadata updaters. And then the processing components, such as the deinterlacing, scaling, encoder components, and multiplexing components. And then next I've got the output component or components. And this is how you would set up your workflow, how we would expect to see that set up. But does anyone have any questions on that layout? Okay, so when you're building the blueprints on premises, you may wish to preview either the source file or some of the metadata passing through a pin at any one point. And you can use some of these components down here, such as the audio preview component or the VU meter component for audio. Okay, now before we start designing a blueprint, I'm just going to explain what the different warnings and errors are that you may see when you start to build your own blueprints. So I'm just going to open the blueprint I made earlier. Okay. So this is just a simple blueprint I started to make earlier, and it's got some of the right components required, not all of them, but we'll get to that. So in the MPEG-4 multiplexer component, the input of track 3 has been illuminated orange, and this type of warning tells us that this particular data stream type is not supported in this input. So you can hover over the illuminated orange there and it will display in the tooltip the error, or you can double click and it will also appear at the top in this window. So you may not know what data type is supported in an MPEG-4 multiplexer, and if you don't know, you can click on the question mark to open the help document. So if you open that, and you just scroll down to accepted inputs. As you can see, I've dragged the uncompressed audio 2 into, and this doesn't support uncompressed audio. So two ways to resolve this would be to either add an encoder of the type that this multiplexer supports or to remove the pin completely. So if I just choose to add an AAC encoder, so if I just type this in and see what comes up, I can drag this in over that active pin, and then that would place itself inside that existing workflow. So that's cleared that message and that component is now happy. However, there's another issue with the ABC video encoder component, this orange C. So this type of warning is a message to let us know that there's a configuration issue within the component, and it will explain as best it can what that issue is. So to reveal what the message says, you just hover the mouse over the orange C, and it's saying that the settings do not fit into the profile level limitations. So profile and level settings have limitations when it comes to frame size and bit rate. So in this instance, we'll need to look into the what the incoming frame size is, what the current profile and level is set to in the ABC encoder, and find out what needs to be changed in order to make the warning go away. So if you look in the help document of the ABC video encoder by clicking the question mark, scroll down to profile and level, so you'll see this table here which shows us what bitrate and frame size limitations are per level. So on the ABC encoder component, now we've got that highlighted, we can see the settings on the right, and we see that at the moment this is set to main level 3. And you can see here, level 3, the max frame size and bit rate, 12.5 megabits per second at 720x576 at 25 frames per second, or 720x480 at 30 frames per second. So now we've checked that, which it looks fine, but we need to see what the frame size is. And at the moment, the output width is blank and the output height is blank. Now, what that means is that the encoder is using the frame size of the existing incoming data stream, so it's not performing any scaling. So to find out what the incoming frame size is, you can double-click on the input pin of the ABC video encoder or the output of the MediaFile input component, and they'll reveal the same settings. So a double-click there will display this window, which shows all of the metadata that can be read from that data stream. So we see here the image height and image width says 1920x1080, and we know that from the help document that that will not be supported with that level. So again, there are two ways to resolve this issue. One would be to change the frame size by adding some scaling to the component, or we can change the level to a level that is acceptable for that frame size. So once you do that, the error will clear instantly. And now all the warnings have been cleared, if we continue to build the blueprint. So I've added my video encoders and audio encoders. I've multiplexed them into an MPEG-4 multiplexer. So we need to add a file output component. Again, I just type in what I want. It's the easiest way to get the component up that you need. And I've hooked that up to the file output component. Now, I just want to press start to show you what an error looks like. So press start, all the components start to initialize, and then you get an error. So the error will illuminate around the component that it thinks has caused the failure. And you'll see at the head of the blueprint, that will also shine red too. So to reveal what the error is, you can click on the red E on the root blueprint, or you can click on the red E on the component that's failed, and then it will give you an error message saying what went wrong. So this is saying that file name is required. So if we click on the file output component, indeed we see that file is blank. So is there a right to complain? So the process of fixing that would be to add a file path and a file name for your output, and then that would be happy to run as it is. Okay, so that's the different types of warnings and error messages that you'll see. So I'm just going to have a quick drink of water. Does anyone have any questions at this point?
Oh, just a question on the AVC encoder. So the AVC encoder can do scaling.
Okay, so if I go back, the AVC video encoder, if I wanted to do scaling there, this would add a scaling component inside it. So this green S means that the component is a dynamic or compound component. And from whatever you set here, scaling, deinterlacing, this will dynamically add the components within it to be able to perform that conversion. So here it's added a video format converter, and it's doing the scaling from that component.
Okay, so each time the user add an AVC video encoder, it will in fact add all these components.
Only if they're set. So if I left this blank, for example, it wouldn't add a scaler component in there. And if I didn't deinterlace or anything like that, those components wouldn't be added. So that's the difference between what we call the compound component and a core component. So the core components are what you would see when the visibility is set to advanced, and all it does is encode to AVC video. It won't do any scaling, and you'll get only the settings that pertain to the AVC encode in the options here on the right, whereas the AVC video encoder compound component gives you many more settings, and then, like I say, it will add those components in if required.
Okay, so it is recommended to use the non-core version?
Yes. You shouldn't use the core version, really. It's just there for specific workflows.
Okay.
But the best thing to note is, if you're leaving these blank, you see all these settings are blank, they're passing through the settings that have already been processed before, or they're keeping the settings from the source file.
Okay.
Okay, so now we're going to talk quickly about expressions and how they are used. The expressions are, they will derive a value from the root of the blueprint. Expressions that do not start with root, though, will derive their value from the current component. So I just want to go back to the workflow I just made, and where the file name was blank, I just want to fill that in with expressions and hopefully give you an idea of what an output file needs to look like. One thing to note, that for use in the cloud, all the workflows should have output write directory expression in the file output components. Okay, so if I just go back here to my error, at the moment the file field is blank. So to populate this with expressions, you would click on the little configuration button to the right, hit expression, and that will now pop up in its own window. And then to prompt the list of expressions that are available, you need to bring up a dollar sign, so on the UK keyboard that's shift 4, and then it will give me a list. So I'll choose root output write directory, and that would be just the directory where you're writing the output file, so you would need to then do a backslash, and then if you want to preserve the incoming source file's base name, you would do root source file base name, and then you could do something like new, or you could add another expression on the end of that, like a start time expression, and then you would add the extension. So I'm encoding to MPEG-4. I know that my extension needs to be a .mp4. I would hit OK there. And then you see the expression populates down here, but the field actually populates with the value that's retrieved from those expressions. At the moment, that doesn't look quite right because there's no output write directory there. And that's because that's a setting that you need to set on the root of the blueprint. So if you left click on the back of the workspace, this output folder variable is what the output write directory, and that's the value that's derived from it. So if I just set an output, and now go back to my file output component, it's now populated with that value. Okay, so the benefit of this, you can have many file outputs referencing the same output directory by using the same expression. And as I said before, it's a requirement for transcoding in the cloud that this expression is used. If you're doing some work on premises, for example, let me just clear this, and then you write to an absolute path. And then you upload this workflow, this will fail because this path is not available. Okay, does anyone have any questions on that?
Yeah, so is it possible to keep the root variable and still do a local test to avoid changing that each time?
Yeah. So let's go back to making my expression. Do my output write directory. Then I'll do the source file base name. And then just .mp4. So you can change the output folder variable here, and you can do local tests here, but when you upload the workflow to be transcoded using the premium processor, it will override this value to something that it can write to on the local VM. So this can be set to whatever you want on premises, and then when you upload it, it will work fine transcoding in the cloud, as long as the file output component is still referencing output write directory. There shouldn't be any issues.
Okay,
so now I just want to start building a blueprint from scratch, and we'll start simple and then add to it and make it more complex. So you should always start by going to File, New Workspace, and then Transcode Blueprint. And the first step is always to define a source file, which is in this user input settings on the right. So if I just go to an available source, and then you would set an output folder variable here. So now you've set that, and you see down in this auto-populated section here, source file base name. When we were using that expression in the file output, this is what it's getting the value from here, this setting that's auto-populated from the primary source file. So once we've done that, we need to start adding components. So the first component I'm going to add is a media file input component. And you'll notice that currently when you add it, there are no output pins available. So what you would do is you would connect this primary source file pin to the file name of the media file input pin, and that's giving this value to the input of the file, media file input. So I'm just going to enable direct show filters, which is, I'll bring this up now. This is one limitation of the current processor. The enabling external filters for direct show or for QuickTime does not work, and I'm not sure how that ever will work. So the only decoding of the files that we can do need to be natively decoded in the media file input component. There can be no external help with decoding files at the moment. But I'm just doing that for the purposes of this test. So once you've added that file, or added the pin, sorry, to the media file input component, it will then generate the output pins based on what it can decode. So it will programmatically add the internal components needed to extract as much data as possible and then generate those output pins. So it's found me an uncompressed audio track and an uncompressed video track. So if I want to encode to AVC, I'll just type that in and add the component, and then I would connect it up. And then I've noticed that as soon as I add that, I'm getting this orange C that we've seen before. And it says input data should specify frame layout. Now, what that means is the metadata is either not contained within the multiplexer or with the source file, or we can't decode it correctly. So if we look down to frame layout, we see that's blank. And the value it's expecting to see there is either progressive or interlaced. So the AVC video encoder and other components also need to see metadata that sometimes will be missing in the source files. So in those situations, we would add a video data type updater component. And then we would just connect this up before the AVC video encoder. Now, at the moment, that orange C is still visible. So once you go in here, we need to go to frame layout, and we need to choose one. And so what this does, it will, if the data properties are missing a value, for example, frame layout was missing, it would replace it with this value here. If the source file, incoming source file, had a frame layout specified and it was interlaced, this would get ignored. The only way would, if you explicitly need to set or override the metadata settings, you would tick this override button. So what it would do is it would ignore what the frame layout was specified in the source files and override it with whatever you set here. So I've just set that to progressive. So one way to see that this has been done, if I double click on the input of the video data type updater and go to my frame layout, I see it's blank. Then if I double click on the output, go to frame layout, I see it's progressive. And now the AVC video encoder has given me another issue, which we've just seen. Settings do not fit into profile level limitations. So what I'll do is I'll just add a scaler in here. One thing to note is you don't have to put the scaler into the component. Some workflows I've seen already submitted to Microsoft, some of the templates, they've got what we call video format converters added before. And then in this component, you can do deinterlacing or scaling. Okay, so now that's set up, you can go into the AVC video encoder and scroll through the settings just to make sure you're happy. once you add the scaling in, you get this option here to change the filter type and control and the number of threads used for the scaling. And then down here you've got rate control and other things that you may need to configure for your output source files. And this is what you would see with the advanced visibility. So if I turned my advanced component visibility off, I get a much more restricted view on the settings that I can change. Okay, so now I'm just going to add the MPEG-4 multiplexer. I'm just going to drag that in. And if you drag it on the output of a pin that you want to connect to it, then it would automatically create that connection. Now if I add a file output pin, sorry, file output component, and then connect that to that. So now I want to just configure the file output to make sure this doesn't throw an error when I try to run a test. Again, I'll start with my root output write directory. And then I'll preserve the source file name. And then I may want to make multiple copies of this file or test with it. So I'll do blueprint start time file name safe, which means I'm never going to overwrite one of the previously written files. Then .mp4. So now that will return me in the file field this correct value. And the blueprint start time file name safe at the moment is null because we've never started the blueprint. But when we do start the blueprint to run a test, it will take those values and write them to the file. Okay, so now I'm just going to add some audio encoding to this. But first of all, I want to see how many channels are on my source. So again, I'll double click on the output pin. I can see that it looks like a 5.1 surround file with 6 channels. So what I may want to do is add an AAC encoder, but I want to only have stereo, so I can either downmix 5.1 to stereo using this setting inside the AAC encoder, or I can downmix and choose another component to do that for me. So either way works, it's the same components being used, just whatever preference you have. So the channel preset 2.0, sample rate, just do 44.1 kHz, and then I'll connect that up to track 2. So now this would be a good time to save the blueprint. And all blueprints save as a .workflow file. So save the blueprint. And I'm just going to use the zoom icons just to zoom out so I can see all the components. And then I'm just going to want to run a quick test. So when you're running the blueprint, you'll see green, yellow, and white pins. Green pins mean that the data is currently flowing through the pins. Yellow means that they're waiting for another pin to catch up to keep the video and audio in sync. Then you'll see at the top of the blueprint you have a progress bar, which is about a tenth of the way through. The media file input component also has a progress bar on how far it's through seeking the file. But this will just write happily till it's finished. So you can test that through to completion, or I'm just going to press stop so my laptop doesn't take off. And so we know that this is working with that source file. I'm just going to exit this. But now we may see problems when we change the source file to something else. So, for example, I'm going to change this to an MXF file. Okay, so you see now we've already got an issue and we've not even started. So if I have just a quick sort of look at my source file, I see I've got 8 audio tracks. My 5.1 to stereo isn't going to be happy because that track has only got one channel of audio inside it. Now this is a common thing that we have to deal with blueprints. So what we do in this situation, we can add an audio stream interleaver. And what this is going to do is take all of these separate tracks and interleave them into one stream. So if I just take the first 6 tracks on the output of the audio stream interleaver, you'll see now I've got number of channels equals 6. And now the downmix 5.1 to stereo will work fine. So this is just one of the issues that we see with audio. I know Xavier was asking about situations where there is no audio in the source files, and we can also handle those situations too. Again, that's using logic branching and some other components, but it can be dealt with. So at the moment, what we've got here is just a simple blueprint with just a few of the key components that we would need. So what happens when we start adding extra components? So for example, if we wanted to add another 7 MP4 layers, for example. So if we just group these components together, shine them all blue, and then you can sort of move them around together. I'm just going to get them out the way. And with my AVC video encoder, I'm just going to copy and paste this several times. So we'll do 6 layers. Again, I'm going to align them up. And then I'm going to just give the name of the component something that I can see and know what they're going to be without having to click on them and figure out what the frame size and bit rates are going to be. So to change the name of a component, you just click on it, and then it will be one of the first fields that you see. And I'm just going to change this to AVC 1920 by 1080. 6 kilobits per second. I'm just going to copy that, make it easier to and rename the others.
So how do you know the name of the component, the original name of the component, if you rename it?
Okay. Yeah, I know what you're asking, because you can rename a component to anything. The best way I've found is either just to click on the question mark, and then at the top, the header or the title of that window, it will say AVC video encoder.
Okay.
So although I've changed the name, it will still have that property. I think you can know that there will be another way.
There's another way through the system tab on the right pane.
Yes, thank you. There you go. So either way, it will reveal the correct name of the component, because
okay.
like you say, you may get customers that want to rename components to what they understand or what they know, and then if you're troubleshooting an issue with their components, you need to know first of all what they are. So,
yes.
Good question. Okay, so I'm just going to continue. Okay, almost there. 6202. Okay, so they're my ABC encoded names. And now I just need to go in and change the component settings to reflect that. So I just add the scaling here just in case the incoming is varied. Okay, so I've done the frame size, now I'll just go and do the bit rate of each of the layers. And because I copied and pasted the first component, they all have the same GOP structure and size. And I'll try and leave the rest of the settings as they are. Okay, so we've added our multiple ABC encodes. We've renamed each component to what we want. And there's a pretty good trick that we have. If you have the same component type and you highlight multiple components, you can just select to add the video on one, and it will generate these pins on all of those components. So I don't want to do that just yet. Instead, I want to group these into their own graph. So if you highlight the components you want to group into a graph, you right-click, do group in, and then graph. And then they'll appear in their own graph. And then you can minimize the graph, so it kind of minimizes the size of the workflow. You'd also rename this to ABC encoders. And how many do I have? Got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But you see that when I've grouped it and there aren't any active pins, there's no input and output pins on the graph. So the way you would get around that is to right-click on the pin and hit Expose in Parent Graph. and then they will all appear on the output of that graph. Now you see at the moment they're all grey, which means there's no data flowing through them. So we need to connect that up at the other end. So I'm just going to do the same thing on the input, but I'm only going to do that once. And then you can borrow that input pin and give it to all of your others. That way you don't have to have six input pins and six output pins. You could have the same input pin, because it is coming from the same video, and just give it to your six different layers. So that's your AVC video encoding. I've got my AAC encoding here. And then this is where you would just add more of these multiplexers. So I'm just going to do Control C and Control V to copy and paste these. And then do my alignment again. Then I'm going to take the track 1 and write that to a file output. I do have a quick question. On your MPEG-4 multiplexer workflows, or your multiple MPEG-4 layers, do you multiplex the video and audio into each layer, or just the video, and then the audio will go into its own layer?
It depends. I think today we don't do it. We have separate track for video and for audio, separate files for audio and video.
Okay.
But some customer probably wants to be able to have an MPEG-4 with both audio and video, because they want to be able to provide this file as a separate download.
Yep.
To some players.
Okay. Okay, so we'll take that situation then. I'm just going to pass the AVC encoded videos, and I will give the MPEG-4 multiplex the audio as well. And then per encoding output, you need to have a file output component. So you can't just hook these all up to that one, for example. I mean, it will tell you can there, but you're going to get some strange results. So you need to, the best way would be to set up one as we have, with this output write directory and root source file base name. And then we can just copy and paste that multiple times.
I have a question on the 7th MP4 multiplexer component.
Yes.
Why are you adding two audio streams to it? Isn't one sufficient?
Just to make sure that you're still listening and watching.
Okay.
No, sorry, that's my fault.
Yeah, all right, that's good. That's cool.
Okay, thank you for pointing that out to me, though. So do the alignment, and then hook this up to the write pin on the input of the file output components. Okay, so in this situation, you may want to, like what we're doing here at the moment with our output, we're doing the source file base name and then a start time. Now, if you intend to encode to multiple layers, you might want to identify them by their bitrate. And I'll just show you another way to publish some field settings so you can use them as expressions. So if I look at the available expressions at the moment, by just hitting my dollar sign, you see I don't have any options to add the video bitrate of those layers, so I can't use that in my expression at the moment. So what you would do is open up your newly made graph by either pressing F6 or clicking the green S, and then you'd click on each of these components, scroll down to the bitrate, and then on the edit button, or the configuration button, you would want to hit publish, and then when it says publish to, you want to publish it to the root graph, and its publish name you could leave as it is, and display name maybe we'll just call it layer 1 bitrate. And then we're publishing that to its own group, which I'll show you what that looks like in a second. So if I hit publish, nothing happens there. The setting stays local to the encoder. But if I click on the back of the workspace, and if I scroll down, I now have a new group called rate control. And I can see the value there from that first AVC video encoder is 6,000. So I'm going to do this for the rest of my videos. Just going to hit the button, hit publish. Again, to root graph, display name, layer 2. And I'll do the same for the rest of the layers. Okay, so if I click on the back of the workspace now, I should have my 6 video bit rates, and I'm going to do the same for my audio as well. Sorry, that's not how we do it. So now I've published all these settings to the root of the blueprint, I can now use them as expressions. And another use for this is when you have these complicated workflows, if you ever get a requirement to change bit rates, you could just change them directly here, and that will follow through to the encoder's settings. So it's good to have, if there are certain settings that you know are quite interchangeable within your workflows, you could publish those to their own group on the root of the blueprint and be able to change them dynamically as you want. I'm just going to save this workflow, and then I'm going to change my file outputs. I'm going to take the root source blueprint start time out of there, and I'm going to search for my newly made. Yeah. So per layer, it's going to add. Oh dear. That's not right. Okay, there's an issue there, and there shouldn't be. Uh, sense, but I'll need to work this one out. For the time being, we'll use these static values. Okay, so I'll just start to connect these up to my output file assets. And again, I'm just going to zoom out slightly before I start the blueprint. Okay, so we've run an error, and it's also important to note that I didn't state this before, that you can normally only see errors at runtime. So when you go to start a blueprint, that's when you'll be met with these errors. And what it's saying to us is the input channel to speaker position mapping is not defined. So what that's telling us is this downmix to stereo component is requiring that the input channels have correct source mapping. So if we just double click on the output pin here, we can see that in all of this metadata here, there's nothing defining or stating that there are speaker positions assigned. So that's where we would add an audio data type updater. And this can sit just below our video data type updater. And again, this will just change the channel mapping if required. So down to speaker positions, if we change that to custom and then selected a 5.1 preset, then that should clear that issue. And we should be able to now run the blueprint. Okay, so now we're getting another issue, and it's somewhere within this graph. So if we look inside, and then we look here on this red E, width or height is not divisible by 4. So it's telling us that the frame size I've set is not a legal setting to have. So if I just change that to something else, and I'll do that here as well, save again and start. Okay, so now it's all running fine. And just a quick one, those errors that I've just run into, you'll see that when you're building blueprints and it all looks fine, you will run into getting different errors and things, and you just have to tweak them before the blueprint can run successfully. So if we take a look at where our outputs are being written to, and they're all successfully writing. If I just stop the blueprint. So there are two ways to stop. You can press the stop button at the top, or you can right click on the back and hit stop or abort. Are there any questions at the moment? I'm just going to show you that after the audio data type up data, it has now defined the speaker positions, and that was what helped to resolve the downmix to stereo that we were seeing as an issue on that component. So the next thing I want to show you guys is the new AMS manifest writer component. And I think if we just type in AMS manifest writer, this is what we get. So we need to define a location to write the manifest file. So I'll do the same expressions as I did for the output assets. And I'll give it the same source file base name as the assets, and then give it the extension .ism. Now you can see that that's taken on the source name of BigBugBunny.ism. Now I'm just going to add each of these assets to it. Save and then start again. Okay, so that's the new manifest write component, and like I say, you just connect the output assets to it, and then it would automatically create that manifest file. So it's a very simple component to use. So what we've done here is, like I say, we've created six video layer MPEG-4 outputs. We're down mixing 5.1 to stereo. And at the moment, this doesn't have any logic, and it works fine at the moment. So if all of your source files were exactly the same as this, same properties, then this would be perfect for what you need. I just want to talk about some other things before we go further into logic and stuff like that. So, for example, this graph that we've made, we can right-click on it and hit export, and that will go to, I'll just call this a graphs folder, and then I'll call it six layer ABC, and that gets saved as a dot graph file. So back down here in this workspace section where I said you can flick between any open blueprint, if I decided that I wanted to adapt this blueprint to have those six layers, I could go to my recently saved If I just hit the refresh button here, go to my graphs folder I've just made, I could drag in that graph. So it's quite good that if you have similar workflows or sections of workflows that you want to reuse in multiple blueprints, to export the graph, which is another way of saying save it, as you see here, and then you can import that into your various other graphs. Does anyone have any questions on graphs, how to make or how to expose pins?
So how did you export your graph? Is it you selected the group
I
of components?
selected. Oh, how did I group?
Yeah.
Okay.
No,
So
no.
if I.
Just the export was done from the group, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So yeah, if I click on the root graph or the blue graph here, and just hit right click export,
Okay.
that's how you do it. You can actually do this per component. So I could export this MPEG-4 multiplexer as a graph.
Okay.
There's no need to do that, for example, but it's possible. So if you had ABC encoders and you wanted to export them per encoder, so you saved what each of those settings were, you could export them as their own graph, and then you could import them. Yeah, so it kind of acts as a preset on a component level. So rather than searching a repository and pulling in an ABC encoder all the time, you could set up some basic settings on an ABC encoder, export it as a graph, and then you could just import that whenever you need to add an ABC video encoder and have less settings to change.
So just a quick question on this. So if you would import the graph, it already had some of the variables published on the to the root graph. But if you would import this into a new blueprint, will this also happen?
No, so that's a good question. So if I'm in my warnings and errors blueprint at the moment, and I've just imported the graph, if I scroll down, I don't have those properties exposed. So the properties get exposed on a blueprint level. So if I'm
Okay.
exposing properties on one blueprint, then transfer some components to another one, the properties that I've published don't go with that.
Okay.
So if you were publishing lots of properties and wanted to maintain those published properties, it's probably best to save the blueprint as another name, and then change the settings to what you need. Yeah.
All right, that's clear. Thank you.
Okay, so we've almost got to what I wanted to achieve today. Is there any other sort of blueprints or questions you have on any of the components used or anything like that we can just go over?
No, I think it was very clear.
Okay, so are there any other questions at all regarding anything we spoke about or anything that you need to understand for yourself? Otherwise, if you want, I could touch on some logic branch stuff today in the last sort of 30 minutes we've got.
Yes, please.
Okay. So, as I say, at the moment, this blueprint, it works pretty well for the file types that we've got set. But if I double-click on the uncompressed video, and then just sort of scroll down, you see my frame layout at the moment is interlaced. So I know that my output MP4s need to be deinterlaced, and at the moment I've not set that anywhere. If I scroll to one of my ABC encoders and check out the frame rate, that's set to pass through, so it's passing through the frame rate and the frame layout, which at the moment is interlaced. So those outputs are all going to be interlaced, which is not something I really want. So we've got quite a good component here called the video format converter, And again, if I just drag that over an existing connection, it just embeds itself in between. And then that's where I would set things like the scaling or the standard that I want it set to. So if I know my top layer is 1080p at 25 frames per second, I can set that and it would auto-populate these fields. And then on the output of the video format converter, if I double-click that pin, I can scroll down and I can see that it's deinterlaced that source file. So if the incoming source file is already progressive, then no deinterlacing will be done. The video format converter will see that the incoming source file is already progressive, and it wouldn't use the deinterlacer component inside it. Okay, so some situations then for the audio, which can be quite complex. So I'm going to scroll down and get these out of the way. So I've got my audio data type up data, which I'm going to associate that with my downmix 5.1 to stereo. And in fact, I'm going to group these into their own graph. So it's the same method as before, group in graph. But you'll notice that because there was already active connections, it's already given these input and output connections. Whereas before, if I copied and pasted somewhere, at the moment there's no active connections going in or out. So when I group in a graph there, then you have to manually publish these settings. So just something to note that if you've already got active connections, you can click on the components and group them, and it will auto-populate those inputs and outputs. So I'm just going to do 5.1. I'm going to call this 5.1 downmix. And then I want to add some logic scenarios. So this is where the logic branch and the branch merger would come into things. So at the moment, I'm just going to bring the logic branch out, and I'm going to delete this connection here. So in the output of the audio stream interleaver, I'm going to go into my logic branch. And I'm just going to double click, because if you single click, there are no settings on the right that we can really change. You have to bring the logic branch settings up in their own window. And then we're met with this scenario. If a data property equals something, yes or no, basically. And to figure out what data properties we have available, you just click on the drop down if there's an active connection already. If this connection down here wasn't active or there was no pin connected, you wouldn't have anything visible here. So if we scroll down to num channels, and we could say, if num channels equals 6, and at the moment that answer is yes, it will go over there. But you may already know that some of your source files have 4 channels, so it's kind of like an if-else statement. You would double-click that now and say, if number of channels equals 4, then you would do something else, and then again, if number of channels equals 2, you would go straight into that AAC encoder. So this is where the branch merger comes into things. So I'm just going to pull out the branch merger over this connection from 5.1 to 2.0. So this AAC encoder is expecting 2 channels of audio coming into it. That's what it's been set up for. Any more than that, then it's going to throw an error. So we need to make sure that everything we feed this branch merger will have 2.0. So is number of channels equal to 2? Yes. I'll put that over there. And you see that these pins are gray, which means we can see actively what this logical scenario is already doing. If I change the source file to another source file with different audio channels, then you would see a different path being gone down depending on the number of audios. So if the number of audios equals 4, what we will do is we can do things like ignore channels 3 and 4. So I'll just add a speaker position assigner, and then in that I'll go to settings, custom, and I'll just override speaker positions that have already been assigned to left, right, and then channels 3 to 8 I'll just say none, so I'm stripping out their speaker position assignments. And then after you've done that, oh, it's actually down here, you use the channel remapper. And what this component does is it will look at what source mappings there are available, and if they match what I've set here, it will follow them through. So as I'm setting my channels 1 and 2 to left, right, channel remapper 1 and 2 are active here, and I've set them to look for channels left and channel right, and then they'll follow through to here. So does this make sense to everyone at the moment, how the logical scenarios are working? Again,
yes.
Check this, yes.
I have a question about the pin, the output pin of the audio stream in Interleaver. There is a pin for done. What?
Yeah. I think that's a pin to go elsewhere when the audio is finished. It's to trigger a different event or scenario.
Okay.
If I'm honest, I've never seen it been used.
And can you re-explain the difference between the speaker position assigner and the channel remapper?
Okay. So the speaker position assigner is just adding metadata to the incoming channels. So if I had 4 incoming channels that had no metadata for speaker positions, I can use a speaker position assigner to add that metadata and say channel 1 is left, channel 2 is right, channel 3 to leave as none, channel 4 to leave as none. And what the remapper's job is it takes the mappings of channels that's been passed to it. So you see here I've done left, right. If I wanted to, I could do left, right, left, right, left, right. And this would take those left, right channels from here and assign them to the output. So I've done channel 1 left, channel 2 right, left, right, left, which means I should have 5 channels here because I'm taking them through multiple times.
Okay.
Does that make sense? I mean, I can try and draw it on some graphs if that would help. Let me just see if I can do that. This is just purely for demonstration purposes. This isn't actually doing anything. Okay, so if I click on my channel remapper, I'm looking for left, right, left, right, left, right. So in 1, for example, would be left. In 2, or channel 2, would be right. And they're the only 2 channel speaker positions I'm looking for. And on the output, I'm asking for them 5 times in a various number of ways. So left, left, left. And I'm stealing or assigning these output speaker positions or output channels from them incoming channels. Does that make any more sense, or is it still a little bit? The more I set in these drop-down menus, the more active output channels I'm going to have.
Yeah.
So if I set these to none, that means I'm not passing through any audio on these channels, only left, right, on channel 1 and 2.
Yeah. And there is no 4 to stereo done mix component.
No, we've got 5.1 downmix or stereo to mono.
Okay.
So you could probably do 2 stereo to monos. It depends on what your assignments are. But no, I don't think we have that component available.
Okay.
Okay, so we've set up logic for 6 channels, 4 channels, 2 channels. And then we can make an assumption further down the line and say, that if that's no, well, then we can either do another thing to say if the number of channels now equals one, then what you would like to do is add another interleaver, maybe, which there's two ways to do this. You could add an interleaver and then just give it the same audio channel twice, and then the output would reveal two channels if that was active. And then you're going to throw your branch merger two channels again. At the same time, or alternatively, you could do the same situation here with the speaker position assigner and remapper and say if number of channels equals one. And then you would say assign this mono, for example. And then in the remapper, you would select mono twice because that's the track, or that's the channel that you want to populate tracks one and two. That okay?
Yes.
Okay. So once you've got your logic sorted out, you'd probably like to group it in a graph, which is just what I'm going to do here, group in a graph, and then I'm going to shrink that down. I'm going to call this just audio logic, and maybe mapping for two channels, something like that. So now we're kind of making our blueprint a little bit more complicated and a little bit more robust, and then after we've done it, we're shrinking down the components we've made to make it easy to manage. And again, I may want to export this graph and call this audio logic. And then you can use this multiple times between your various blueprints. If I just refresh this. Oh, that's not what I wanted to do. And now that will also appear there available. And that should run fine. And then you can add this to situations where you know that the incoming channels will be 6, 4, 2, or 1, and then you have your desired two-channel output, as you can see here, and then you'll have your correct speaker position assignments as well. Okay, is that all understood quite well?
Yeah, a question about the audio logic. So inside your audio logic graph, you basically you connected the second branch to the output of the first branch, but can you also connect this branch directly to the first pin?
Like here, for
Yes,
example.
like here. Yeah, is it possible?
Yes, yeah, that is possible. So yeah, you don't have to, and we'll try this little trick again. So you don't have to do it the way I did it. Oh, oopsie. Yeah, so I do it that way because it's the data is flowing down one sort of line. Whereas here you're going four ways and making decisions independently, but I don't think it ultimately matters which way you choose to do it. What I would stress though is this branch merger is extremely important, and especially if you're doing it like this, where you're feeding four independent components of the data flow and then making decisions off of them, you need to have this branch merger on the output to condense them all down. So you see, I've got four logical scenarios, and I've only got one active output pin. So doing this, for example, is not really recommended. So if I bypass that branch merger, because some components will still think it's receiving data from multiple data flows, and that would cause the blueprint to fail. So,
And
just something.
the branch merger, what's happening if it receives several stream?
It will fail. So you need
Okay.
to make sure that you set it up correctly.
Okay.
But it will fail, and just like a component further downstream would fail. But the difference is this will take those no data pins or no data streams and will block them from passing further down the blueprint. All right, is that okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so that's some logic on audio. If you want, I can also kind of throw in what would happen if you had no audio. Do you want me to run through that right now?
Yes, yes, please.
So think of it like this. So at the moment, I've got six audio tracks going into an audio stream interleaver, and from there, going into logic branch. If I had absolutely no audio, this wouldn't be making decisions. You see how all of these pins have gone white? This, these logic branches, they don't cope with no data streams coming into them. So we need to kind of account for that. And so if we build this backwards now and say, in this scenario, we've got no audio, right? So we can generate audio silence, which means this will always feed the audio stream interleaver something. So at the moment, it's set up to send two channels at 48 kilohertz, 16-bit depth. And if there's no audio from the source file, if this was no audio, then we know that if I set this to say if number of channels equals 2, then that means that there's audio silence. So I'm going to remove all this and start again. And it's always best to sort up your audio stream interleaver for the maximum amount of audio that you think you would receive or intend to use in your output. So at the moment, I've got all six tracks hooked up. And I'm just going to pop my audio silence in there as well. But the problem that you notice first off is it's saying that there's bits per sample mismatch, which means that my 16-bit depth is not compatible with the input. So we can get around that temporarily by changing the bit depth on this audio silence component, but we'll need to change the bit depth on all of the tracks going into the interleaver to be able to make it cope for varying bit depths. But for now, so I've got six channels, and then I've got two channels of audio silence. So I'm going to add my logic branch. And I know now that if number of channels 2, that there's no audio. Okay, so does everyone understand how that's worked? Okay, so this is feeding two channels of audio to the interleaver. So if there was no other source, this would receive two channels, which means there are no audio channels coming from the source. Even if the source had mono coming in, that would still make this situation 3. So we can go back to now say, if number of channels 3, then I know that it's mono coming in. Now, I'll try and open up a blueprint from one of my customers. Okay, so again, their source files, they have up to 8 tracks of audio on the source. And what they want to do, if they if there's no audio on the incoming, they want to change the output file name to say no audio at the end. They want to append no audio to the output file name. And they're doing this again with the audio silent source, which is going into the audio stream interleaver, again, the very last track. And then decisions are made out of the back of this. Right, so they're using a very similar situation to what your customer needs. And again, so this end of stream notification is important. So if I go back to my workflow, end of stream notification. Okay, so this is important to tell the audio silence to stop. So when the uncompressed video or the video stream has stopped, it will send an end of stream notification to here, and then that will stop the audio silence from continuing to go on forever. So this is an example of the done pin over here. The done just sends a command. So for example, it's sending this a stop command or a stop trigger to stop the audio silence from continuing forever, basically. Otherwise, there is no way to stop it. Okay, so that's it for me today. Thank you all for attending, and but in the meantime, I hope you all have a good day, and speak to you tomorrow.
Yes, thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.